Sorry, guys, I'll listen to the rest of this endless voicemail message later.
Long messages are the worst.
That was very long. That was an especially long one. I'm glad you cut it off.
Long and
we're gonna
sell an app where every 30 seconds that you leave a message, you get an electric shock through your phone.
I support that. In fact, I would pay to install that on other people's phones.
I would pay to install it on my dad's phone. Because my father, he will call, and you know how like the in your voicemail has like a little time stamp of how long it is? Like 2 minutes, 6 seconds. And it will be my dad. He's in the car, so he decided to call me. And he's on his way down to, you know, wherever in town to do an errand. And he's just reciting what he's doing along the way. It's like,
because
oh,
of course you want to know.
Yeah, he's narrating his errands. That is the voicemail.
I understand the impulse to want to narrate your own life. I do it in my head sometimes.
Yeah. That, like, isn't that what Twitter is all about, water,
don't
actually?
Don't leave it on my voicemail.
I just don't listen to voicemails.
Yeah, you know, you don't read your email, you don't listen to voicemails. It's amazing that anyone ever reaches you at all.
And I'm so much happier. And
I would say you're one log cabin away from being the Unabomber, but you have a log cabin.
Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the You're Nobody Till Somebody Hacks You edition. I'm Shane Harris of The Daily Beast, and we're back after 2 weeks.
We missed you, Shane.
I missed you guys, too.
Did you get hacked in Maine?
Nobody hacked me in Maine.
You got a nice tan, though.
Do you think I look tan?
You look very relaxed.
That's nice.
The first person ever to go to Maine for a tan.
Well, it's because it's this very rugged island that we're on, where everyone's like all like very leathered and very like, you know, wind chapped, and they're all out.
They
working.
Chop their own wood and catch their own.
No,
it's like a Land's End catalog.
It kind of is. It's this crazy island that there's like, it's one.
No, it's Maine. It's an L.L. Bean catalog.
Yeah, it's L.L. Bean. Okay, yeah, you know, you can take in like a piece of clothing to L.L. Bean, a lifetime guarantee. You can like take it in like.
Yeah, you can take it, return it anytime for any reason. Yeah.
Don't say Rational Security never taught you anything.
That's right. That's right.
We're good for something.
We were hacked by bugs in our house, though. All kinds of bugs. It's very buggy.
They got in through all the screens.
Putin sent them.
Putin did send them.
But we will have revenge in the object lesson section.
We sure will. We're going to show you. We're going to show you what we saved up for you, Vlad. A lot has happened since we've been away, huh? Yeah.
I know.
A few things have happened. We're going to try and get to some of them this week on the podcast. The New York Times and maybe the NSA get hacked. Is the U.S. turning the tide on the war in turning the tide of the war against ISIS? And October surprises. What could happen between now and the election? And will it even matter?
Doom.
Rational Security speculates wildly.
I predict doom and destruction.
Everybody else does it. Why can't we?
Sure. And
death.
For the record, a lot of our predictions have actually been pretty good. I'm just going to say. Maybe we'll get to that later in the podcast.
Pestilence.
The four horsemen of the apocalypse over there.
We had a locust invasion when I was in Maine. So, like, we're on to the next one. Let's start with the news this week that the New York Times... was revealed by CNN actually this week, apparently was targeted by possibly the same Russian hackers who hit the DNC. I think the New York Times is saying that there's no evidence that there was actually an intrusion, but, you know.
Can I just say that these hackers are sort of like turning into Kaiser Soze? Whatever goes wrong in cybersecurity in the world...
It must be the Russians. It must
be we're now attributing to this group of
It's getting a little
hackers.
Crazy, right?
Well, I also sort of feel like there's going to be, if there isn't yet, there's going to be a competitive dynamic with media organizations. Like, you remember a few years ago, there was that Google warning that popped up on people's Gmail saying you may have been compromised by a foreign government. And if you didn't
get one.
I got one.
I didn't get one.
But, you know, if you didn't get one in Washington, you just weren't cool. And I kind of feel like, you know, if the Russians haven't hacked you this summer, you obviously don't count.
You're
part
nobody.
Of the power structure.
So here's the thing. If you knew that you had been hacked or targeted, would it be in your interest to say it? Or would it actually be a very bad idea? Because that might make you seem less than trustworthy.
Maybe we should announce that Rational Security has been hacked by the Russians.
I mean, our Twitter feed's not active enough to have been hacked by the Russians.
Dude, no. We don't even have an email account.
It's true.
Dear Russia,
that's not
I forgot
laziness
the password
of disorganization.
To our
that's operational security.
Oh, of course.
Because actually, when you think about it, Rational Security really doesn't exist. I mean, it's just like it exists.
It exists in our hearts.
There's a podcast server, which. Is not in the name of an organization, Rational Security.
So you're saying we're a distributed network?
We are a distributed network.
Like
I mean,
terrorists.
It's actually impossible to hack Rational Security.
We're so bad.
The Lawfare's been hacked.
Lawfare has been
targeted DDoS.
It has had a series of DDoS attacks.
But the more interesting hack, I think, that we might want to talk about is actually one that's not necessarily being attributed to the Russians, even though you might think it was the Russians based on their Boris and Natasha-style post that was put up claiming responsibility, a group called Shadow Brokers, which claims that they may have hacked the National Security Agency, whatever that means. But
see what happens when you go on vacation, Shane.
The NSA gets hacked. See, if I'm around, they're protected. This is
that is the correlation.
It truly is. I am Shadow Brokers. I am Kaiser Soze. You thought you'd hack me in Maine. It's the other way around. But this is a fascinating issue because the material that has been published by this group or individual calling itself Shadow Brokers does contain exploit code. I mean, it contains real sensitive stuff that a number of experts are looking at and saying this seems to be the work product of the NSA. They're basing that in part off of documents that were provided to The Intercept by Edward Snowden. It's not entirely clear to me if they were in the group that was provided a couple of years ago or if he's leaking new documents. I'm a little unclear on that.
It seemed to me like they sort of cross-referenced documents they had.
That they already had that maybe they had
reported on. See if there was indication of the same
type. Right, so they find some stuff in there that says, hey, look, the code and the information that's showing up in this leak matches up with known programs and known operations that are described in the Snowden cache. I guess one question we could start with is, there's a lot of questions we have about this, but one that I'm sort of curious about is, okay, so this information is out there. Putting aside for a second, we'll get to this in a moment, of how somebody could have gotten to this, which I think is the more interesting question. Is this stuff even that revealing? I mean, it is apparently a couple of years old. October 2013 seems to be the latest iteration of the information that's out there. The NSA, it will come as no surprise to people, probably changes up its operations and tactics relatively frequently, and particularly after the Snowden leaks, which were before this information was dated. So one question is whether or not this stuff is even all that useful. And if it's not, then why go to the bother of putting it out there?
Right. So I think it's not clear. Again, most experts sort of agree that this likely is authentic material from the NSA. I haven't examined the exploit code independently. But sort of operating on that assumption, I think the usefulness is sort of, it's really a question of how big of a hit is it to the NSA's capabilities. How much are they losing? It's certainly reasonable to believe that they might still be using something that was in use 2 years ago, right? So it seems like the material was probably stolen or hacked or however it was acquired around October 2013, although those dates could have been altered. So even that is not sort of conclusive evidence. I think that there's been 8 exploits that are revealed in Cisco systems and otherwise. You could guess how valuable those targets might be. But
it's a pretty ubiquitous technology, so it could be very valuable.
Right, although the idea that there are only 8 exploits, right, or that they're of such criticality, I think the bigger hit is not necessarily the actual loss of those exploits, which can be solved with money and time and, right, sort of the worst thing you lose is a lot of work and potentially insight into a target. It's its impact on the larger conversation. So there's already been a lot of criticism about the NSA retaining vulnerabilities that exist in, for example, U.S. infrastructure in order to capitalize on it for operational purposes. So there's been a lot of controversy and debate around the vulnerabilities equities process, the NSA merger. This is the kind of thing that mixes that whole debate up again.
It's a nice specific example, too, isn't it?
Well,
like,
I think
here are 8 exploits that the NSA was keeping from manufacturers.
Well, and this raises another theory that's out there about why I go to the bother of revealing this stuff, which is getting back to a conversation we had a few weeks ago about assigning responsibility and sort of creating public accountability for hacks is that, one theory is that this is a sort of a deterrent strike saying to the United States, oh, well, if you're going to ascribe responsibility for hacks to the Russians using, these various techniques, just know that we have ways of fingerprinting your work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so this can go two ways, and it's sort of a deterrent against efforts to ascribe public accountability.
So maybe this is something that we're leaving around, hanging around for a rainy day for...
I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, the sequence of events here is important, and it's DNC hack gets attributed, or quasi-attributed. Big speculation in U.S. media and government circles that DNC hack is a specific effort to intervene in U.S. elections. Lots of hand-wringing about that.
And demand for sanctions and demand for all kinds of retaliatory action.
Exactly. And then a sharp reminder that somebody has their hands in NSA's pocket.
Right, but I think it's important to be clear about the difference in attribution here, right? So there is technical indicators. There's a lot of sort of specific concrete evidence for attributing the DNC hack to particular Russian actors. In this case, sure, we might say, well, you know, this was leaked as a reminder of attribute, you know, that the Russians also can attribute against the NSA, or the NSA also engages in hacking activities around the world. The problem is that there's not, other than that kind of broader speculation of, well, who else could it be but the Russians, there actually isn't any evidence that the Russians are necessarily behind the leak. And remember, right, the source of the information and the source of the leak could also be two different people. Considering the kind of chaos actors that we've seen as of late, right, WikiLeaks and, you know, sort of hacktivists and all the different organizations that are popping up, that their sort of animating principle appears to be, like, radical transparency at its most coherent and pure mischief at its sort of...
denial and deception, really. I mean, it's...
Right, so, like, I wouldn't be surprised if some group unrelated to the Russians somehow had this information and decided that this would be a really fun time to release this information.
Do you want to say something?
No, go ahead.
So this gets to the interesting question, which I've been grappling with, and I'm going to lay a theory on you guys, and I want to get your response.
And we'll shoot it down.
So the question has been, so who did it, right? And we've actually seen very rapid attribution in some of these past cases, the DNC hack, the DCCC hack, the New York Times hack, which was sort of immediately attributed to, yes, it's Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear again, which sort of raises a whole host of questions. Well, how do we know that?
Like, how fancy is your bear?
How fancy is your bear? We're very cozy with our bears lately. But there's been sort of the conventional wisdom in the past week or so about how it was that shadow brokers or whomever obtained this information got it, is that it was taken off of a server someplace outside the NSA's physical confines, right? So their network confines, often called a staging server, where the NSA goes and says, we're going to sit here on this server, and then we're going to go zap our bad guys from this server so it doesn't look like it's coming from Fort Meade. Okay, fairly straightforward. And that some, you know, dumbass left this file sitting on a server someplace, and it was come along and snatched. For a while, that made some sense to me. And now, that makes totally no sense to me for the following reason. The information, if we're to believe what we're seeing is authentic NSA information, was not encrypted. It looks to be a combination. It looks like a cookbook. It basically looks like, here's some exploit code. Here's how you build the exploit code. It looks a lot like a training manual. It looks a lot like information that you would have inside the NSA for the use of instructing operators and analysts on how to conduct these operations. It also makes no sense to me that an agency this sophisticated would leave unencrypted, unobfuscated training manual information on a server from which it was conducting actual operations. I mean, that sort of seems to me to be like, we have war plans at the Pentagon. We don't just, like, take the war plan out to the battlefield and go, wait, let me flip to appendices, you know, 12 here, and then leave it laying around. This seems to me to suggest there's the possibility that this is actually somebody who had access to it inside the NSA and released it that way.
Why is everyone looking at me?
Look,
I did not take that information.
Susan leaves NSA. Few months later, this material shows up.
Mm-hmm. Coincidence?
Coincidence?
It's a logical inference.
Yeah.
What do you guys think of that?
So that is an interesting theory that has been offered by many people that are have lots of interesting backgrounds and insight.
not to be vague at all.
Not to be totally vague.
But it doesn't seem like the going theory,
but
right?
I will...
It seems like the counter theory.
Sure. I mean, right, they're sort of right. There are the two basic explanations, right? It either got stolen through, you know, it was either hacked or it was an insider threat, right? That's... Broadly speaking, that is sort of the categories
sure.
of how
my question is like the logic of why it looks more like an insider threat.
So I think two general observations. One is that I would, just in general in intelligence, I would never discount the possibility of a mistake or stupidity. I think so often from outside kind of the classified space, it seems like these masterminds at work and they control every piece and this and that. Mistakes and luck and happenstance, I think, are far more significant. And so,
and if anyone has any doubt of that, just think about the reply all button.
Exactly,
it sure. happens to everyone.
But here's the next question about that. If you are okay, so let's just say this was material that somebody very foolishly left lying around on a proxy server or a staging server, whatever you want to call it. To be the person who then absconded with that information, you'd have to know which server out of the millions and millions and millions of servers of physical infrastructure out there to look at. So did they just get lucky?
There are a lot of people out there snooping around for all kinds of stuff. And
all right.
Somebody got lucky and came across it and sold it to the highest bidder.
Look, I think that the bigger question is whether or not we are going to get any kind of additional public information or sort of insight into this. And I would say this is an area, whatever the actual explanation is, the answer is no. Because just like we saw in the DNC hacks and even with Sony and sort of the other kind of headline attribution cases, we've seen that there really is a need to give a lot of technical information, right? Nobody just trusts the U.S. government that it was the Russians, that it was the North Koreans. They really are sort of obligated to prove their case, show their work. Wherever this happened, right? If it's sort of if it's internal to NSA networks, if it's a staging server, sort of the plausible universe of technical information, there's no way that's going to be taken to the public. And so I think that, one, we almost certainly aren't going to see U.S. attribution. And two, if we were going to see attribution in the kind of, you know, vague leaks, I don't know that it would be enough to genuinely be convincing.
I think that's right. I think this is just going to be one of those long-term mysteries that waits until somebody writes a memoir 20 years from now.
Well, and
I
think
20
that...
years. They need to know now.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the electronic age, memoirs can come a little quicker. But I also think that...
Because you can hit backspace.
Right. What you're both saying, to me... lends strength to the notion that fundamentally this is about signaling.
Yeah.
It's about the conversation, the sort of sub rosa conversation about where this cyber war is going.
Yeah.
And I do think sort of that it is worth making the general point about kind of the insider threat because, of course, you know, to the extent there's, you know, this is a second Snowden, how could this happen, you know, to the extent there's any sort of credibility behind that theory or it gains momentum, I do think it's sort of important to understand that whenever it comes to insider threats in particular, there's only so much you can do. A huge amount of this work in community is based on trust. When mm-hmm. people have to have access to sensitive information in order to do their jobs, you have to trust some group of people. You can do your best to vet them and check them and put them through metal detectors and psych evals and whatever else. But at the end of the day, there's kind of only so much you can do there. Mm-hmm. And so just sort of contextualizing what exactly the challenge is moving forward.
All right. Let's move forward to our next topic. So the war against ISIS, it's going great. Important victories, turning the tide, Donald Trump is totally wrong. Or is it a bit more complicated than
that? There's so much winning.
Yeah, there is a lot of winning, but it may be a little more complicated than that. Tamara, bring us up to speed on the winning and why it's, maybe we shouldn't be necessarily popping champagne corks too soon.
Sure. So I think what we've seen over the last couple of weeks, and particularly over the last few days, is both a set of complications and, in many ways, in the broadest sense, escalation of the war in Syria and of the fight against ISIS. And a couple of developments are significant here. One is that the Syrian regime, with the support of Russia, has significantly scaled up its bombing of civilian areas in Aleppo province, with the goal of just pounding rebel-held areas, whether it's meant to depopulate those areas of civilians or whether it's meant to soften up the rebels for some kind of broader Syrian-Russian advance. So that's one part of it. The second part is the decision by the Syrians, again, with the support of the Russians, to conduct airstrikes against American-supported opposition forces further to the north, including Kurdish forces around Hasaka. And this provoked the United States to launch its own airplanes to wave off those Assad-allied aircraft. And, you know, there was an incident a couple days ago of a close encounter between Russian aircraft and U.S. aircraft after a long period of time, nearly a year, in which there's been very, very careful deconfliction, as the phrase goes, in the airspace over Syria. Two things, I think, come out of this. One is, wow, the U.S. seems to be declaring a de facto no-fly zone above the areas where its allied forces and its special operators, let's not forget, are based on Syrian territory. And if it can do that, why couldn't it do the same thing over areas where civilians are being subjected to daily bombardment? But the second thing is that it's the first time that the U.S. seems to be using the threat of military force in any way to kind of put a red line, sorry for that maladroit phrase, to draw a fence in any way around Syrian and Russian behavior in the civil war. And again, it begs the question, why now, why here? And if you can do it here, why not do it elsewhere? And so I think it opens up necessarily a set of questions about American strategy and about the inevitable connections between the American campaign against ISIS and the outcome of the civil conflict in Syria. Now, simultaneously, over the last couple of days, we've seen the Turks prepare for and then last night embark on an operation that I think the United States would have wanted to see them undertake a year and a half ago, which is a cross-border incursion into northern Syria to push ISIS back from the Syrian Turkish border. And not coincidentally, right now, there's a secondary aim, which for the Turks may be the primary aim, which is to insert Turkish force and Turkish allied Sunni rebels between two pockets of Kurdish controlled areas on the Syrian side of the Syrian Turkish border and prevent the Kurds, the Syrian Kurdish forces, from creating any kind of unified belt of territorial control along the Turkish border. And I think it's fascinating that the Turks have finally decided to do this now. They were, as we all know, very slow to try and tighten their own border with Syria to try and constrain ISIS from crossing back and forth against this border. But they've now crossed a Rubicon. And I think that there are two drivers here. One is, as I said, the threat posed by this burgeoning Kurdish zone of control. But the other is what's happened inside Turkey, which is that since the attempted coup against Erdogan, he now finds himself with a much broader political coalition supporting him than he ever could have imagined. His approval ratings up to 68%. The nationalist Kemalists, who always hated him, are now backing him. And so he can undertake this risky military operation with a much more secure footing at home.
Does that suggest that he always wanted to do this but just felt constrained?
Well, you know, that would be a really generous interpretation. The other interpretation is that he didn't really want to do it, but the Kurds have forced his hand.
Yeah.
So I have a question sort of about it feels like there's been a shift in attention in the United States, or a shift in feeling. It's ebbed and flowed a little bit throughout the 5 years of conflict, right? So sort of that initial intensity around kind of the red line and, you know, I think the presumption on behalf of a lot of people that we were going to be conducting military operations, and then, you know, a real sort of political, you know, backlash against that, so it didn't happen. And there's been a few moments where particular images have sort of captured the public imagination. You know, I think everyone saw this, you know, really heartbreaking image of this little 5-year-old boy in Aleppo. One of the things that I thought was really interesting this week is this is the first time that I've really seen such a strategic and unified response among kind of the policy community. Previously, it seemed like whenever sort of attention shifted to Syria, it was a lot of, this is really complicated, here are all the problems, here are all the sort of, you know, pros and cons, and nobody understands it, and it's all chaos. And so it wasn't clear where sort of the lay public or public opinion was supposed to sort of align behind. This is the first time that actually across a number of different sort of political spectrums and in different publications, I really saw a lot of specific suggestions being offered, right? So if you care about that picture, here is what you should be at, you should be telling your president to do. Establishing a safe zone, establishing no-fly zones, this, that. Is that, do you think that it's just the policy community has sort of solidified around a set of options? Do you think that they understand there's a new recognition? I mean, is this an effort to potentially shift the administration's calculus?
Well, this is really, it's an interesting moment, actually, because I think across the policy establishment, or what President Obama might call the bubble.
Or the blob.
There's been a fair bit of consensus that the administration's approach to the war on ISIS could not succeed in the absence of a different approach toward the Assad regime in Syria, that the attempt to have a wall between these two policies was an inevitable failure. And more recently, I think a sense that, boy, you know, this administration is so dug in on this, they're never going to shift before the end of their term. We're going to have to wait for the next crowd, and sort of the launching of a debate about what should the next administration do on Syria. And then also, I think the administration had the cover of this diplomatic process with John Kerry flying off to Vienna or to Moscow every other day to work with the Russians somehow and achieve a diplomatic end to the war. And two things I think have happened that have changed the conversation. I don't think it's the policy establishment that's changed. I think public sentiments are changing, and I think the administration may be starting to change. The diplomatic effort is a shambles. It's a disaster. It's achieved no progress toward ending the war. Assad is as firmly entrenched as ever. The civilian toll is horrific, as that picture symbolized, and there's nothing left for Kerry to do. I think that's undeniable at this point, and so everyone has to reckon with it. The cover is ripped off. And the second thing is that the administration's war against ISIS has proceeded, as you noted, Shane, to such an extent that the Syrians and Russians now have conflicting interests with us on the ground. And the administration cannot avoid that conflict if it wants to succeed in its anti-ISIS campaign. And so somehow it has to confront Syrian and Russian behavior without going too far down that slippery slope that they're so, so worried about in the White House, getting sucked into the Syrian civil war. And so perhaps there's a moment of opportunity here for a policy reevaluation, but I have to say, having watched the administration deal with this for 5 years, I'm pretty cynical that we're going to see a significant shift.
Yeah, I don't think there's any reason to think that there's a window of opportunity here. I mean, there's been a window of opportunity anytime the administration wanted to take some risk to get involved, and it's never wanted to take some risk to get involved. Whether that could have been done successfully or not is a unknowable question, but there's no reason to think there's a window of opportunity now in the absence of precisely the set of things that they're not willing to do. And I think the defense of the administration on this is that they chose to take no risk and let things play out as awfully as they were going to. And they've gotten exactly that. And, maybe that was the right call from a purely realpolitik, amoral approach, but it's very hard to argue, now we've kind of reached this point where, you know, there's going to be a big payoff for, you know, for this sort of policy of kind of hands off, you know, let Russia and Assad do their thing, policy. It's, you know, it's a choice to have allowed a bloodbath. We've had the bloodbath, and we continue to have it, and unless and until we step in to stop it, that's exactly what we're going to have. And I think you sort of make a moral and strategic choice about whether you're willing to tolerate that or not. Barack Obama clearly is. I think we've learned a lot about him in the course of this. But the idea that, you know, this sort of hands-off approach has produced a window of opportunity for something beautiful strikes me as
that wasn't what I meant to imply. I guess
I don't mean it's what you meant to imply, but I do think it's a kind of idea that's sort of in the air now that, you know, now that people have seen this picture,
right all along.
This poor. See? People have seen the picture of the poor boy, and all of a sudden the world is spurred to action. There was even a New York Times headline of, I think it was a New York Times headline of, you know, can this picture spur action where no one else, where nothing else can? And the answer is no.
You guys are so cynical.
So let's be as cynical as Ben for just a minute and think about it from the perspective of the Obama administration's political imperatives between now and January 20th, okay? They need the war on ISIS to be on a positive trajectory with significant progress before they leave office. They've made some hints that they have some specific goals in that regard, territorial goals in Iraq at least. And they need the Syrian war not to blow up in their face in a way that that reveals the degree of their realist cynicism. And so, you know, what might happen here? The Iraqi part of this anti-ISIS offensive has significant constraints because the Iraqi government and the Iraqi military simply are not capable of winning these battles, of retaking Mosul. And so that leaves the option of, if you want to proceed, doing so with Shia militias that compound the political and sectarian divisions inside Iraq and maybe, you know, maybe defeat ISIS, but may leave something worse behind. And in the Syrian case, we've reached a point where Assad, having been allowed free rein to bombard the opposition, is now extending that campaign against the U.S.-allied anti-ISIS opposition. And so I think on both fronts, the U.S. is facing some hard limits to its strategy for success. And somehow I think the Obama administration is going to have to figure out how it gets from now to January looking like success.
I mean, I just want to say I don't think what I said was cynical at all. I think that, you know, it is I think you can make a perfectly good case for having gotten involved earlier in a substantial way. And I think the administration, to its credit, in my judgment, makes a pretty unapologetic case for staying out of things on the grounds that they didn't want to get embroiled in a quagmire and they didn't want to risk a whole lot of U.S. lives. I think what you can't do is combine the two. And the, you know, if you're going to take the position that the administration takes, you have to accept the moral consequences for it, which is that you've stood by and let some number of hundreds of thousands of people die or be displaced. And I don't think that's cynical to point that out. I just think, you know, what drives me kind of bananas is the way John Kerry talks about this in moral terms, having done exactly nothing to stop it other than to talk to the Russians in a very polite fashion.
Right, but I do think that there is a way to view the administration's imperative between now and January as the preservation of Obama's legacy. And so potentially, I think the non-cynical or maybe, Pollyanna optimistic hope here might be that there is some combination of focused political attention along with an understanding by the administration that this is going to be a stain on Obama's legacy, that it really is going to be part of the story of his presidency that is not flattering to the administration and that history will likely not be kind to that judgment. And that there are new emerging facts, like the use of incendiary weapons, confrontation with U.S. troops, that might give the sort of, I don't want to say like plausible reason, right, or pretense, but it might sort of say, okay, this is something new that actually might merit or allow for a reevaluation.
And then they do a sort of on the way out the door policy shift the way George H.W. Bush did in Somalia and handed it off to Clinton?
I mean, if they know that Clinton is very much is oriented towards that kind of policy, I don't think it's absurd.
Yeah.
Interesting hypothesis.
Well, there's a lot of time between now and January, including the month of October.
nice segue,
like
Shane.
Yeah. So October surprises. There could be so many. There could be so many surprises. It'd be fun to sort of get a sense of what could happen between now and the election and will it matter. We've talked a lot about what could happen in Syria. I want to offer up, actually, two thoughts. One where I do not think there will be a surprise and one where I think there could be. So there will not be a surprise from the 14,900 additional emails that the FBI found that Hillary Clinton did not turn over to the State Department. 14,900. Remember, she turned over 30,000? 14,900.
You know how you know there will not be a surprise?
Because there was nothing in the original 30,000.
Well, and also because if the FBI had found a big surprise,
they would have
indicted
her.
It would have changed the outcome of the investigation somehow.
Yeah. So it was sort of a. I only point that out just to say that yes, this week we found out that there were 15,000 additional emails lying around, and Jim Comey likes to talk about the slack space of various servers. I'm not exactly sure what the slack space is.
No, but it sounds so cool.
It sounds
really
cool. I wish
I had more slack space in my closet because then maybe I would open and read all of the email I get from Bloomingdale's every day.
Oh, well. I mean, in particular, so where we might see surprise, I'm going to go ahead and say it. Someone somewhere has hacked Donald Trump's tax returns, and they have them. And they're going to release them in October.
Is this just wild speculation? Or
the wildest. No, it's the it's like, I just think if you look at the state of the world right now and you look at, because apparently like everything is out there. I mean, think about it. Somewhere his accountant has copies of his tax returns. I presume they're not only on paper. It just seems so obvious to me that somebody somewhere would have figured out who his accountant is and hacked them. Or like found the data center in Ogden, Utah, where the IRS keeps everyone's tax returns and taking it.
I don't see that being an October surprise because all of the actors who are strategic-minded enough to wait for October don't seem like the hacking types to me, right?
No, I mean, we're underestimating them.
It's like Debbie Wasserman Schultz put in a hoodie in front of a laptop, like the hacker pictures.
What are your guys' predictions for October surprises?
Okay, well, here's my speculation on what won't be an October surprise. And I could well be wrong, but I hope that I'm not wrong. I don't think that there will be a new Russian offensive in Ukraine between now and the election, because I think that to the extent that Putin does have an interest in affecting the outcome of the American election, that would push things in the wrong direction for him. But I do think that there could be some other Middle Eastern crisis as outside of Syria, outside of Iraq, that will force a conversation that we haven't really had in this presidential debate yet, a serious conversation about American foreign policy. And that could be a new round of Israeli-Palestinian violence, for example, or a crisis in Algeria with the death of Bouteflika, who's been on his deathbed for God knows how long. And that would affect oil markets, and that would affect the economy. So those are two potential scenarios for Middle Eastern October surprise.
So my prediction, I have a prediction of sort of that's the same of what will be an October surprise and what won't it be. And that's that I think that there will be an attempt to release information or leak information about the Clinton Foundation, about, you know, some sort of alleged smoking gun, donors for access, et cetera. And I think it will end up being more sort of noise.
Kind of like the Secretary of State meeting with the deputy head of state of a major Arab partner government, and that's a scandal.
Right. So I think that there will be yet another sort of there will be some sort of a you know, genuine appearance of impropriety, but largely a manufactured scandal. And I would bet that so either conservative super PACs or, you know, Trump himself will sort of go all in an October offensive, trying to really hammer kind of the Clinton Foundation as a corrupt vehicle. And yet I can't imagine that an actual sort of smoking gun emerges. And then for the other side, my guess for an October surprise is that some piece of information linking Donald Trump's businesses to actually illegal activities comes out. So the guy has a lot of mob ties. I think there's potentially some kind of smoking gun there. And I think there is potentially some kind of smoking gun with the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, right? Something that the kinds of federal statutes that are not widely known to the average American, but can have ensnared far more savory businesses whenever they attempt to use money to exert influence abroad on winning building contracts or otherwise, right? That is a crime in the United States. So my guess is that there is something that they will use in October to sort of put the nail in Trump's coffin by saying he's a crook.
Ben.
Well, let me start with what will not be an October surprise. I think there will not be an October surprise. I think everybody is...
Oh, Ben, you're no fun.
No, hang on. Everybody's exhausted. Everybody just wants this stuff to be over. And
there's no market for an October
exactly.
surprise.
There's no market for an October surprise.
No one cares.
Nobody wants this election to be more exciting or more interesting. And so the October surprise that won't be there is an October surprise. That said, what will be an October surprise? Here's what's going to happen. Guess what? Donald Trump is going to continue to make outrageous comments offending new and different constituencies that you didn't know that he could offend, that you haven't even thought of. I mean, there are some white people out there whom he still hasn't pissed off.
Left-handers, maybe.
It's going to be amazing.
They're very sneaky people. You can't trust them.
It's going to be amazing. Losers. How many people he offends between now and it's not just October, by the way. He's got September too.
Oh,
and he's got 2 full months to piss off whole categories of, no, he started on Mormons this week. So, you know, there's some
which
work.
Which when you're down in Utah is probably not
there's
smart.
Some work to do on Mormons still. He's still ahead a little bit in Utah and he can finish that off. But I think he's going to go down one state at a time. Identifying the key constituencies he needs to upset to lose more states. And he's really going to go after that.
Joe and I talked a lot about this on vacation because, you know, what else are we going to talk about? And, you know, in my Occam's razor theory was if you're operating like Donald Trump, there's only two explanations. Either you're crazy or you're trying to lose.
Maybe both.
Yeah. And I think I favor number two because what he's trying to do is clearly is build a business.
Yeah.
I think the business is actually going to be a media network and associated properties.
I think the Occam's razor here is that he has absolutely no idea what he's doing and he's in way over his head.
Hugely over his head.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not, look, I
he's
think
the dog
I have
who caught the
more,
armored car.
Right.
Yeah.
And look, I think I have more judgment than Donald Trump. But if all of a sudden I found myself at the end of August as the you know, major party nominee, and I hadn't hired anybody, and I was kind of guessing, like, what was going to happen next, I don't think I would be running, like, a beautiful, seamless campaign, right? I think it would be gaff after gaff.
You'd be running a great campaign under
this. I'm sure it would be wildly entertaining.
It'd be huge.
Right, but, like,
turn it around.
I think we've all had the experience of getting in way over our head in something and then just kind of wishing it would go away. Unfortunately for Donald Trump, he's in it, and it's not going anywhere now. And he's going to have to carry this thing to term, to borrow a phrase.
He should bring the rational security team in to run his ground operation.
Oh, God.
Did you see that there's a 12-year-old in Colorado running his campaign?
Hey, I worked on political campaigns when I was 12.
Did you run the campaign office?
No, I knocked on doors.
I bet you could have run a campaign.
Children are our future.
Maybe by
guys.
14.
Let's move on to object lessons. Ben, do you want to start?
So you guys may remember that some time back I had a little collection going of Putin memorabilia. Well, this week... Quinta Jurassic, Lawfare's new associate editor, brought in what may take the cake for Putin memorabilia. It is Ukrainian Putin toilet paper.
Yes.
So that you can wipe your ass with Vladimir Putin's face.
What's he saying?
Well, so, I don't read Ukrainian.
It says make clean.
But the...
it says two-ply.
This is PTN, which I assume is Putin without the vowels.
Uh-huh.
And this is...
Putin.
I don't know what this is. It's some kind of, I assume, obscenity. And then this just says blah, 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 I think.
Well... There's been a lot of speculation.
It's not flattering.
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation that Putin is an asswipe, and here's
your proof.
We're going to put a picture of this on the website, so if anyone here
can interpret this. If anybody has good Ukrainian and wants to give us a specific readout on the Putin toilet paper, otherwise it's just going to go up on my desk next to the Putin-scented candle and the other awesome Putin items. By the way, update, still no word from the Kremlin on my challenge to the president of Russia to meet me in single combat.
He's an asswipe and a wimp.
It's true.
Yeah, he's a wuss.
Tomorrow, your object.
All right, well, this is an odd little card, as you can see. But this represents my entry into... a small and I felt very privileged community that I got to be a part of for 4 days last week. I was resident at the Chautauqua Institution.
Oh, look at that.
On the beautiful shores of Lake Chautauqua in upstate New York, or I should say in western New York near Buffalo. I was told this is not, in fact, upstate New York.
Oh, wow.
But for those of you who may not know, the Chautauqua Institution was founded in the late 19th century by a group of Methodists who wanted to have a Bible school and train Sunday school teachers, and then it became revival meetings. And over the more than 100 years since then, it has emerged into an intellectual colony that appears on the shores of Lake Chautauqua every summer for 9 weeks. Each week has a theme. And there are lecturers, there are authors, there is opera and symphony and theater.
And there's Tamara Kaufman Wittes.
And this year, for just a couple of days, there was Tamara Kaufman Wittes during the week on War and Peace.
Wow.
At the Chautauqua Institution, lecturing on U.S. policy in the Middle East and what may come next for that disordered region. So it was a sobering week just because of the topic. But, wow, what a fascinating community to be steeped in for a few days, and it really was a lot of fun to be there.
And you got to beat the heat in Washington.
Oh, my God. It was like 70 and cool at night with the windows open. Delicious.
Lovely.
We should start a kind of like nerd summer camp.
National Security Summer Camp?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe our editor and producer, Jen Patya Howell, can host it at Montpelier,
ooh,
which is the... historic home of James Madison, where she works in her day job.
We'll show you, Aspen.
Everybody show up at Jen's house.
Tomorrow.
Salon Jen.
Susan, what's your
object? So my object lesson is a Lawfare post that is a list that I put up yesterday, sort of amplifying a point that Amy Stepanovich, who's at the Access Now, had made about the fact that recent media coverage and panels on government hacking, which happens to be a topic I engage in, there was a mysterious lack of women in all of that coverage. And on
there was
all
a
of
no ovary panels. Zone.
But Susan, isn't that because there are no women in tech policy?
Exactly, exactly. They're smaller lady brains. They aren't interested in these issues. So as a sort of rejoinder to that, I put up a very brief post just noting that there are a lot of women in tech policy, and here are a few names. And I invited people to submit their suggestions of whenever you're organizing a panel or a journalist reporting on a subject, what women sort of in tech policy you should be thinking of and talking of, imagining it would be sort of a, you know, modest, you know, list form of what women also know stuff and foreign policy interrupted, FP interrupters has been doing in those disciplines. The past 24 hours, my phone has not ceased to send me notifications with people tweeting and emailing me just lists upon lists upon lists of the names of accomplished women in tech policy.
Binders full of them?
But I could nice. I could print them out and create binders and binders of women. One, it's heartening, and it's been a fun 24 hours reading about all these incredible women who work in this field. Two, I'm not really sure what to do now because there are so many people. So I'm hoping that some very motivated organization can sort of take the baton from here.
Or if a rational security listener wants to curate the binders full of women list on Lawfare, get in touch with Susan.
There you go.
Let her know. All right, that brings us to the end of the podcast. Rational Security is a production of Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find our show archive at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. You can follow us on Twitter at RATLSecurity and download the podcast from iTunes or Stitcher or other your favorite podcatchers. And when you do, please, please, please remember to leave a rating and reviews. We really appreciate getting those. Now that we're back from our vacation, maybe we'll read some of those next week. So let
at
your friends know.
At our vacation? You mean your vacation.
Hey, you
vacation.
Guys could have gone someplace.
Actually, I was in Maine as well.
You were up in, like, Lake Titicaca or whatever.
Is that really the only lake you can think of?
It's my favorite. Speaking of Putin toilet paper. Anyway, leave a review. Welcome back. It's almost, the summer's almost over. Our show is produced and edited by Jen Howell. Our music is performed this week by the Fancy Shadow Brokers. You like that?
That's good.
It's
that's
like
good.
Merging them together.
Yeah. It's kind of like NSA and the Shadow Brokers.
Well, it's kind of like the Fancy Bear, Shadow Broker. Fancy Bear's responsible for everything, you guys.
Yep.
Yeah.
That
they
is
run
true.
The world.
They totally do. They're the new
Who
Illuminati.
Run the world? Fancy Bear.
Fancy Bear. Fancy Bear equals new Illuminati. No, our music is performed, of course, by Sophia Yan, who is a fancy shadow broker in her own right.
She's a fancy bear.
She's.
Oh, man.
I'm not sure she'd like that.
We should get Tammy to say that with her voice right now.
Yeah. All right.
That's Sophia Yan. It's one fancy bear.
Yes. Yes.
Sophia, you make that your ringtone.
Do it. On behalf of my friends Ben Wittes, Tamara Kaufman Wittes, and Susan Hennessy, I'm Shane Harris. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.